So in Dublin, sometime in the early 80s, on the last day of the month of March, a mother in child pain clenched her teeth, dug her knees home into the bed, sweated and panted and grunted, became a tense living mass of agony and effort, groaned and pressed and groaned and pressed, and pressed the little boy out of her womb into a world where white horses and black horses and brown horses and white horses and black horses and brown and white horses trotted tap, 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 tappity-tap over cobblestones. So this is how one of Ireland's greatest playwrights, Sean O'Casey, describes his birth on March 3rd, 1880 at 85 Upper Dorset Street, just a short walk from where we are now, as John Casey in the first volume of his autobiography, I Knock at the Door. Although best known for his plays set in Dublin slums, again set in the general sort of environs of where we are now, O'Casey was born into a lower middle class Protestant family. His father was a clerk and brought home about £2 a week, which was not an insubstantial sum of money in 1880. But he died when O'Casey was six, and the family sort of slid further and further into poverty during his childhood. He was the third John in the family. The previous Johns had died, one in early infancy, and the second at a year old. Although he was more robust than the previous ones, at five, it was noticed he had a severe eye condition, trachoma, which is a contagious bacterial infection of the, which affects the conjunctival covering of the eye and the cornea and the eyelids. And it's often associated with poverty and lack of proper hygiene. And this caused him tremendous pain, intense pain, in fact, for the rest of his life. When he was eventually taken to a doctor, it was suggested that he couldn't go to school for quite a long time. So Michael Casey, his father, was the son of a mixed marriage from County Limerick, his father being a Catholic and his mother being a Protestant. So so he was brought up most of the family were brought up as Catholics. But when the mother died, or she brought him up, when the father died, should I say, she brought her youngest son, Michael, up as a Protestant. So when the mother died, this became somewhat of a conflict with the rest of the family. And he left and came to Dublin. So he earned his living as a commercial clerk for a number of years, and then worked for an organisation called the Irish Church Mission, which was a proselytising Protestant organisation dedicated to the cause of Superism. Now, Superism was the practice of offering food to starving Catholics once they converted to Protestantism during the Great Famine. So Michael could have earned much more money in the commercial world, so he obviously had a strong religious conviction that led him to work for the ICM. Michael was quite well educated and well read, and the house was full of books. So Sean grew up surrounded by books on theology, the works of Dickens, Scott, Thackeray, Shakespeare, Milton, Burns and Keats. His father did, though, resent the fact that Johnny, as he was known, because of his eyes, would, in his opinion, grow up a dunce. Michael had little regard for his son's ability, and according to O'Casey's biographies, he had little time for him. Johnny was close to his mother, however, particularly because she had to constantly attend to his eyes. And with his father's death, as I said, the family's fortunes began to slide deeper into poverty. And they moved from Dorset Street to the nearby Inishfallon Parade. So I grew up with my own father quoting lines from O'Casey's plays. So I was aware of him during my childhood. But it wasn't until my late 20s when I stepped onto the stage as Donald Davron in an amateur production of his first real success, The Shadow of a Gunman, and subsequently in the Plough and the Stars, that I began to get some sense of the playwright and the man. Reading his plays then and the autobiographies, I found a voice who was speaking somewhat my own thoughts, whose ideals 50 years before gave a form to sort of political ideals that I was forming, and to some extent religious ideals that I had been forming when I stopped practicing Roman Catholicism in my early teens, and began to search and formulate some alternative philosophy in an Ireland that was very much dominated by the Roman Catholic Church. Now, despite what the title of this talk might suggest to you, I'm not making any claims that Sean O'Casey was a Buddhist, or even influenced by the Buddhist teachings. But hopefully by the end, you might agree that his vision and ideals have parallels in Buddhism. Now, autobiographies would normally be a mine of information about a life, but O'Casey's are an eclectic mixture of fact, fiction, and almost surreal mixture of both in 6 volumes. So he did write quite a lot about himself, but it's not all true. And it's like, some of it is quite surreal. Sean's education began at his sister's Bella school. She was 15 years his senior. And although attendance at school throughout his childhood was sporadic because of his eye problems, it really meant he had no real sort of formal education. Bella did sort of tutor him at home to some extent. In his autobiography, though, for some reason, he killed her off a decade before she died. She died in 1918 in the great influenza epidemic. But he killed her off 10 years previous for some reason that's really unexplained. Kind of indebted to the research undertaken by Mary Morrissey for her novel The Rising of Bella Casey, setting the record straight really for about Bella and her relationship with Sean, or Jack, as she and the rest of the family insisted, and in interviews I've heard, relatively recent interviews with sort of relatives of his, still living relatives of his, they insist on calling him Uncle Jack. They none of them call him Sean. So it did Mary Morrissey sort of set the record straight about his relationship with his sister. So Sean eventually left school at 14, getting jobs. At least at first, by rights he shouldn't, given his lack of education, but his Protestant religion gave him some privilege. He succeeded in losing job after job for what appears to be insubordination, which in a way he celebrates, he's quite proud of it in his autobiographies. Seems to have regarded his work supervisors as his intellectual inferiors. Despite his own lack of formal education. And he didn't mind criticising them sometimes to their faces for their lack of knowledge of literature, like Shakespeare and Milton. All he seems to have cared about at the time was having money to buy books. And to the extent that in his free time he seems to have scoured the bookstalls of Dublin looking for books. And sometimes he'd even go hungry to sort of keep the money to get a particular book that he really wanted. So he continued to lose job after job until he ended up as a labourer on the railways for the Great Northern Railway, a job he wasn't really sort of physically suited to. But he hadn't really much choice. He'd exhausted all other avenues. So living now in Hawthorne Terrace in East Wall, the family slipped further down the social ladder, eventually ending up sharing a house in Abercorn Road. So East Wall at the time had a very large Protestant population, many of them from Ulster due to the Great Northern Railway. The Great Northern Railway tended to sort of employ workers from Belfast, and so most of them were Protestant. Like his father, Sean, or John as he was still known, was a devout Protestant and was given attending St. Barnabas's Church. And the Protestant population of the parish was given in 1900 as 800, making it a veritable sort of Protestant enclave in a very Roman Catholic Dublin. And it was a strictly working class area. Now, Casey was to spend the next 20 years there before he made any success with his playwriting. He was befriended by director E.M. Griffin, and who became, like, he had lost his father at 6 years of age. So Griffin became somewhat of a father figure for him. And under Griffin, the choir began to sort of sing well, and Johnny sat with them singing lustily when he was in the mood. And all his life, Casey was a singer, though not always of hymns. Lots of his plays have songs in them, and he did enjoy music. But he was very much a part of church life. One of Griffin's daughters later remembered him as being very devout. And she wrote, at weekday prayer meetings, he would frequently volunteer to lead the final prayer. He sat behind us and we were afraid to turn around and look, but soon we heard his voice ringing out loud and clear in that drawling, lilting way he had of speaking. He didn't read from the prayer book as the others did. He just made up his prayers as he went along, using some biblical passages, but mostly his own words about the glory of God. He would have made a great preacher. Well, there's some would say that he did actually make a great preacher. See, it's not surprising how sort of orthodox Sean was, or Casey was, in his piety at this time. But that was the change. Most of the congregation, as I said, of St. Barnabas's were from Northern Ireland, and so were Orangemen, and or members of the Orange Order. So when Sean joined the Gaelic League, he was ostracised from the parish and he drifted away from the church. And his workmates in the Great Northern Way at that stage used to call him Irish Jack. So it wouldn't be too much to say that John Casey became a fanatic for all things Irish, which was unusual for someone of the Protestant religion in Ireland at the time. He joined the Irish Republican Brotherhood in 1905. So this was the militant organisation which later would be behind the organisation of the 1916 Rising. He was also a member of the GAA and he took an active part in sort of Irish games. So in all three of these, the Gaelic League, the IRB and the GAA, he was a wholehearted participant. And this is testified by Ernest Blythe, who later became the managing director of the Abbey Theatre. And in his memoir, Trashin' an Abona, which was published in 1957, he sent a copy to O'Casey and he wrote in it, "The Hian O'Casig Le docus not girig she farager," so to Sean O'Casey, in the hope it will not anger him. So the reason for Blythe's unusual diffidence lies in the full and frank account of O'Casey's politics from 1906, when Blythe first met him in Dublin, until about 1912, when O'Casey dropped away and Blythe marched on to a some success in Ireland's sort of independence fight. So from this point on, John Casey mutates into Sean O'Cahasic. And it seems clear that the Gaelic League was a recruiting ground at this time for the IRB, for the Irish Republican Brotherhood. So the practice was that a member might recommend somebody for acceptance, who would then be secretly investigated, and if all was well, he would be inducted by means of a formal initiation. So O'Casey, it would appear, inducted Blyde into the IRB, and it's apparent from Blyde's account of the IRB circle that O'Casey was highly thought of it in. So Sean, who adapted and wrote little plays with his younger brother Isaac from his early teens, now in addition to his studying Irish and recruiting for the IRB, began to write and perform a serial for the Drumcondra branch of the Gaelic League. And this was to be, there was to be much more along these lines after 1910 and up until the Dublin lockout of 1913. Which was a major turning point in O'Casey's life. As 1911 wore on, Sean decided that the slave for the railway company, as he called himself, would be a slave no longer. A new militant class consciousness was growing within him, fostered far less, as one might imagine, by the Irish Socialist Republican Party, led by James Connolly, whom O'Casey intensely disliked, than by the man who was to become his next mentor, the man he dubbed the Irish Prometheus, Jim Larkin. The year 1911 was one of upheaval internationally. Workers sought to take advantage of boom conditions, but not in Ireland. That's where Jim Larkin came in. And he's now regarded, in certain circles, and certainly by me, as the greatest moulder of Irish freedom, and in its broader sense in the 20th century. A statue in Dublin's O'Connell Street, just up the road of Jim Larkin, has these words of O'Casey's inscribed on the plinth. From a window in the building is what was the Imperial Hotel, what was Cleary's, which is now a derelict building. Larkin spoke from that building to a group of workers in 1913 before there was a baton charge and riot. From a window in the building leaning well forward, he talked to workers, spoke as only Jim Larkin could speak, not from an assignation with peace, dark obedience or placid resignation, but trumpet-tongued of resistance to wrong, discontent with leering poverty, and defiance of any power strutting out to stand in the way of their march onward. So O'Casey threw in his lot with Larkinism and the plight of the poor. He was sacked by the Great Northern Railway after a strike in support of railway men in Britain, but he didn't go without a fight of words, which he published in Larkin's The Irish Worker. His sacking from the GNRC was another turning point in O'Casey's life. He was never again to secure full employment. The shock of dismissal radicalised him, confirming his admiration for Larkin's uncompromising view of the labour question. When 1913 arrived and the lockout burst into confrontation between workers and employers, O'Casey was in the thick of it, organising a committee to help workers and children and haunting Liberty Hall day and night in attempts to be of public service. The writings he did at this time were functional, bits and pieces of commentary on or intemperate attacks verging on libel. The strike was ultimately a failure, and when demoralisation set in, following the collapse of the strike in January 1914, and the workers returned to work with no extra money, it was O'Casey who suggested reorganising the Irish Citizen Army. Further, O'Casey drafted its constitution, adopted in Liberty Hall on 22nd of March. O'Casey was now elected the secretary of the ICA, and he took a major part in recruitment in County Dublin and drilling exercises in Croydon Park in Merino, where Larkin had set up a kind of a leisure centre for union members. O'Casey had clarified for himself a fairly complex set of political choices and opted for the militant workers' defence. So the Irish Volunteers founded in November 1913 to declare opposition to Carson's Ulster Volunteers. Attracted most of those men who had been members of the Gaelic League and of the IRB, whom O'Casey had known, so Blyde, Sean McDermott, and of course Pierce. He was just as militaristic as they were. But he had now narrowed his sights to make not England but Irish capitalists his target. In his article written in the Irish Worker for January 1914, he made a clear distinction between the cause of the volunteers and that of the unskilled workers. They were polarised between because the volunteers had a bourgeois agenda. O'Casey had left the IRB, and his move put him on the wrong side of those for whom the volunteers were the logical extension of its militarism. Having isolated himself from the mainstream of Irish nationalism, O'Casey proceeded to isolate himself from the Irish Citizen Army. The bone of contention was Countess Markovitch. She had dual membership of the Women's Auxiliary of the Volunteers coming them on, and of the ICA. And O'Casey thought she should choose. She could, so to speak, nail her colours to the mast. And he actually thought she was a spy for the volunteers. The rest of the ICA didn't agree with him, and he walked out. He could be quite a belligerent character. He had an opinion and he stuck by it, and he walked out anyway. So he's walking out of the ICA. He'd shown it, cut himself off from the exciting political developments, whatever one thinks of them now, gathering momentum in Ireland. He who had helped to design the flag, the plough and the stars on the blue background, and also wrote the history of the army. He was soon to lose Larkin too. Now himself broken and in need of rest, before the end of the year, the exhausted Larkin would be in an exile, later a prisoner in America. Somehow Sean would have to pull himself together on his own. He was also having trouble with swollen tubercular glands in his neck for some time, and surgery was now required to drain the abscess. So he went into St. Vincent's Hospital in Stephen's Green on August 1915. On referral from the ITGW, Larkin's Union. So by 1915, the same hospital was being used as a field hospital for Irish soldiers who were wounded in the front of the First World War. And O'Casey later remembered a host of wounded soldiers dressed in blue with red ties, with whom he talked and sang as well as strolled in Stephen's Green. For most were walking cases, like himself. And O'Casey was to use this experience later when writing to Silver Tassie. During this period, he renewed his interest in theatre from the 1890s and a stage outing with his brother Isaac. This time a theatre group associated with the Union and run by Larkin's sister Delia. He also appears to have started writing plays at this time, but nothing remains of this work. O'Casey was the first modern writer to point out that warfare in the 20th century was as dangerous for the non-combatants as it was for armed soldiers. But at the same time, O'Casey felt uncomfortable about his non-participation. It was natural for him to feel a modicum of guilt, even though he was under no obligation to take part in the rising. It has been well said that the writing would have happened without O'Casey, but O'Casey the playwright would not have happened without the writing. It shaped his imagination. O'Casey failed in the world of action, but turned aside to justify himself in the world of art. His early forays into writing for the stage were with the St. Lawrence O'Toole Club in Savile Place. Again, not far from where we are now. But he fell out with them, again falling out with people. He did make a habit of that. He wrote two plays for them, The Harvest Festival and The Frost and the Flower. And at the same time submitted them to the Abbey. And the Abbey objected to them, or sort of rejected them. When he went back to O'Toole's with them, they didn't want him because the Abbey didn't want him. So he had this letter from the Abbey. So we're sorry to have to return these plays, for the author's work interests us, but we don't think either would succeed on the stage. So lurking behind this royal plural were the unwritten signatures of the directors Lady Gregory, W.B. Yeats and the manager Lennox Robinson. So O'Casey was later to sort of develop a deep friendship with both Lady Gregory and W.B. Yeats. So in a letter to Robinson on the 9th of October 1922, O'Casey added that he was well into another play entitled On the Run. This was to become The Shadow of a Gunman, his first real success set during the War of Independence. Its roots lie in the unlikely setting of Micheál Omeilon's bed-sitting room at 35 Mountjoy Square, then a tenement. Where O'Casey was living, Micheál was a colleague of O'Casey's in the Irish Citizen Army, who, according to O'Casey, was a very, very, very well-read lad, had a marvellous memory and could recite Shakes, Shelley and Burns without effort. He was to provide the outline of Seamus Shields in The Shadow of a Gunman to O'Casey's Donal Davern. Whereas O'Malon admired O'Casey and recognised his genius, he said he knew Shakespeare by heart as well as he knew his Bible. But he saw O'Casey as once a black orange man, always a black orange man. What O'Malon made of O'Casey the free thinker is hard to say, for he heard bits of Shaw out of his mouth, much more than he heard from other philosophers. This odd couple were doing fine until one night the Black and Tans arrived. So 35 Mountjoy Square was raided. Because O'Malon says he had a reputation as a native speaker and in that context, a nationalist. And the neighbours around us thought that Sean was on the run, and they would try and be gentle and kind to him. And this is basically the story of The Shadow of a Gunman, a largely autobiographical play. And neither Donal Davern, the play's version of O'Casey, or O'Casey himself, did riddle very much to just disavow the neighbour's misapprehension. In a sense, I believe O'Casey was writing out his part in a cathartic way in the sort of genesis of the rising and the subsequent War of Independence, and at the same time pointing out the futility of it all. And this is where I believe O'Casey the pacifist begins. In the character of Minnie Powell, O'Casey begins to examine the futility of armed struggle and its effects on the non-combatants, rather than on the army or the IRA. We also see O'Casey's first strong female character, sacrificing and bearing the hardships of the deeds of men who surround her. And O'Casey's work is full of these women, these strong women who, despite what the men do, survive. In Juno and the Peacock, his next play, set during the Civil War, perhaps his greatest creation, Juno Boyle, another woman suffering victim to the folly of men, her husband the peacock, the show-off, the braggart, whose son was wounded in the hip during 1916 and loses an arm fighting with the IRA in the Civil War, declares he would do it all again for the principle, for a principle's a principle. Juno replies, "Ah, you lost your principle, son, when you lost your arm. Them's the only principles that's any good to a working man." So Juno sees life in terms of the essential human situation. Bread on the table and love in the heart. They are the only realities that have any meaning to her. When she finally loses her son, who is eventually shot, she keens a heart-rending lament. "What was the pain I suffered, Johnny, bringing you into the world to carry you to your cradle? To the pains I suffer carrying you to the world, to the bring you to your grave. Mother of God, Mother of God, have pity on us all. Blessed Virgin, where were you when me darling son was riddled? When me darling son was riddled with bullets. Sacred Heart of Jesus, take away our hearts of stone and give us hearts of flesh. Take away this mordant hate and give us thy own eternal love." But the men go on sacrificing themselves and the murdering hate continues. But this time O'Casey goes back to the start, to 1916 and Easter week, to the Dublin tenements. A complex play of characters from the socialist, an orange woman, British Tommies, a patriot, a wife whose husband, despite her pleading, goes to the GPO to fight, plus the ordinary poor of Dublin held hostage by both sides as Dublin burned, including a prostitute, Rosie Redmond, and a girl dying of consumption. Again, Nora Clitheroe, the pleading wife, like Juno, realises there can be no victory in a war for them if they lose their men and their homes. They repudiate war and the illusion that the soldiers alone are the ones who suffer. O'Casey was mocking disillusion by looking at the brutality of war through the realistic eyes of working class Irish women instead of through sentimental patriotism. He fell foul of this sentimental patriotism when a section of the audience rioted at the sight of a prostitute in a pub while brave patriots stood outside under the tricolour. O'Casey is sceptical of rampant heroism of the patriot and more concerned about the individual heroism of those struggling with life in the tenements. I think O'Casey's feeling is best expressed in this piece from the autobiography volume, Drums Under the Window. "A rare time for death in Ireland, and in the battle's prologue, many a common man, woman and child has said goodbye to work and love and play. And many more in an hour or so would receive a terse message that life no longer needed them. There they are, lying so quiet, a child surprised in the doorway, an old man stretched in the street, a young man near a lamppost which he clutched when the bullet struck him, and down which he slid when he died, his curiously white face containing wide eyes staring upwards, as if asking the sky why this had happened, a stiff arm still half encircling the lamp standard. A young lassie in holiday attire, lying on her face, maybe hurrying home when she heard the uproar, but going too slow, for the brilliant white blouse, a purple patch of death, was spreading over the middle of the back. An old woman on the floor of her tenement alone, her blood seeping through the ceiling below, all the goodly company of the dead who died for Ireland. Jesu, have pity. Quiet, comrades, quiet. It was necessary that you should die for Ireland too. You didn't want to die, I know, I know. You signed no proclamation. You invaded no building. You pulled no trigger, I know, I know. But Ireland needed you all the same. Many will die like that before Ireland can go free. They must put up with it. You will be now unknown forever. You died without a word of praise. You will be buried without even a shadowy ceremony. No bugle will call your name. No gunshot will let loose brave echoes over your grave. You will not be numbered among the accepted slain. So when Sean left for London in March 1926, the criticism of the plough ringing in his ears, some of which hurt him especially hard, from people like Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, a formidable feminist and Republican, the widow of the socialist pacifist Francis Sheehy Skeffington, murdered at Richmond Barracks by a mentally ill British officer in 1916. O'Casey had praised her husband in the story of the Irish Citizen Army as the real hero of 1916. In Sheehy Skeffington, and not in Connolly, fell the first martyr to Irish socialism, he wrote. But she was an effective as well as vocal disruptor of the production in Act Two of the Shadow of the Plough and the Stars. Significantly, she was to be appointed to the executive of De Valera's new party, Fianna Fáil, founded later in 1926. Mrs. Sheehy Skeffington was not finished with O'Casey yet. She later wrote to the Irish Independent, criticising it play. He did intend to return to Ireland, but for the moment he was enjoying himself in London, being somewhat of a celebrity, surrounded by theatre people. In the summer of 1926, Sean met Eileen Reynolds, an Irish-born actress, whom he was eventually to marry. So in September of the same year, he started work on his next, and in my opinion, his greatest play, The Silver Tassie, based to some extent on his conversations with soldiers when he wounded at the front while he was in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin in 1915. Turning his attention from war in Ireland to war in the First World War in France. Set partially in East Wall, partially in the trenches of France. So a militant pacifist indictment of organised legal murder and a society that would sanction and defend that murder. The main focus of the play is the second act, which opens in the lacerated ruins of what once was a monastery. The core of the play has to do with the stupidity and blasphemy of war to end all wars. The major difficulty lay with Act Two, set behind the lines in France, after the main characters, infantrymen, leave Dublin for the front. There follows the illustration of war Yeats was to object to when he rejected the play. Here O'Casey forsook realism for what is a headlong plunge into surreal expressionism, a far cry from the realism and tragicomedy of his Dublin trilogies. Time and space don't exist. On a slight groundwork of reality and imagination spins and weaves new patterns made up of memories, experiences, unfettered fantasies, absurdities and improvisations. As I said, this was rejected by the Abbey. The reason usually given for the Abbey's decision to reject the play is that Yeats mistrusted O'Casey's passionate pacifism and doubted he understood the experience of war. But he must also have wondered, after the riots that greeted the Plough and the Stars in 1926, how an Abbey audience would react to another play denouncing violence, this time played out by Irishmen fighting for the British crown in the First World War. O'Casey wrote, criticising Yeats' opinion that he didn't understand the experience of war, saying that if he wasn't qualified to write about this, he taunted Yeats. Someone, I think, wrote a poem about Tiernan Oak, who never took a header in the land of Ute. So there's an electrifying moment in the second act of Patrick Mason's 2002 production of The Silver Tassie. Ironically, this is the section of the play which is often judged to be too difficult to stage, because it departs radically from realism of the rest of the writing of the play. And to sort of emphasise its operatic quality. In fact, there has been an opera produced, a purely opera version of the play. O'Casey directed that the actors, soldiers waiting to go to the front, should chant their lines like Gregorian plainsong. So Mason took full advantage of the challenge to heighten the dramatic atmosphere. As the soldiers turned their back to the audience and faced into the rattle of the enemy's guns, a shower of poppies, red petals, flutters down onto the stage to mark their sacrifice. Wait a moment, I was at one of those productions. So Sean O'Casey went on to write until his death in 1964, despite his lifelong problems with his eyes. None of his plays really achieved the success of the Dublin trilogy, and he banned performances of his plays in Ireland after a controversy over one of his plays, The Drums of Father Ned, was to be performed at Untostal Festival in 1958, when the Archbishop of Dublin, John Charles McQuaid, said a vote of mass wouldn't be said in any if any plays of O'Casey were part of this festival. Of course, in Ireland of the time, if the Archbishop, the Archbishop always had his way. So O'Casey responded by saying that none of his plays would be performed again in Ireland until during his lifetime. O'Casey died in his home in Devon in 1964. So when one reflects on the total image of the man, evident from his plays, his autobiographies and his other writings and interviews, he loved publicity. He liked talking. We see his faith and his courage, his frustrations and his often present frailties. It's hard not to see O'Casey himself in this description of his idol George Bernard Shaw, another Dublin visionary. The earth was his home and he loved it. He was at home among the mortals. His epiphany was the showing forth of man to man. Man must be his own saviour. Man must be his own God. Man must learn not by prayer but by experience. Advice from God was within ourselves and nowhere else. Social sense and social development was the fulfilment of the law and the prophets. A happy people made happy by themselves. There is no other name given among men by which we can be saved, but by the almighty name of man. So to me, thinking of the iconic verses of a Buddhist scripture called the Dhammapada. The opening parish section, although, as I have said, Sean O'Casey was not a Buddhist. These lines, these first two verses, I cannot see any incompatibility by what O'Casey wrote about Shaw, and which I feel he's essentially writing about himself. So experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. And I could go on, but I won't. In his play, The Star Turns Red, he demonstrates his idealistic communism. And in his autobiographies, towards the end of a chapter, A Terrible Beauty is Borneo. Sean wanders through the grim slum streets, probably passing by our door here, as it was, wandering with hurt and anger through these cancerous streets, that they were incensed into resigned woe by the rotting houses, a desperate and dying humanity, garbage and shit in the roadway, where all the worst diseases were the only nobility present, where the ruddy pictures of the Sacred Heart faded into dead dullness by the slimy damp of the walls oozing through them. The few little holy images the people had, worn, faded and desperate, as the people were themselves. Many times as he wandered there, the tears of rage would flow into his eyes. How just his magnificent rage. But as if to stop himself going mad from the terrible grief, he thinks hopefully about life in Russia, a Russia he'd never seen, and his visionary imagination takes over. The red star is a bright star. No pope, no politician, no cleric, no press lord can frighten it down now, or screens its rays from our eyes. It is the evening star, the shining star. He continues to extol the virtues of the communist ideal as he sees it. Morning star, hope of the people, shine on us. Star of power, may thy rays soon destroy things that are foolish. Red mirror of wisdom, turning the labour in factory, field and workshop into the dignity of a fine song. Red health of the sick, red refuge of the afflicted, shine on us all. Red cause of our joy, red star extending till thy five rays covering the world, give light to those who sit in the darkness of poverty's persecution. What a beautiful image, how ideal. But is it what was Russian communism? I think not. Those of you familiar with Buddhist puja, Buddhist devotional ritual, might be mistaken for thinking that was some invocation to some deity or other. This glowing, almost biblical incantation would lose none of its power in such a setting. And this is a characteristic example of what O'Casey means when he said he is a red. And what I mean when I say said the same thing, and mean to some extent when I say I'm a Buddhist. There is much point in O'Casey's claim that he was a communist before he had ever heard of Karl Marx. Communism isn't an invention of Marx. It's a social growth developing through the ages. O'Casey's red star is an ethical symbol. It's not a political one. It's a universal symbol of his humanistic creed. In a sense, as we Buddhists might have it, metta or universal loving kindness, having its analogues in Blake's Vision of Jerusalem, Shelley's Unbound Prometheus, Shaw's Communistic Christianity, and maybe the movement for liberation of the so-called Untouchables in 1950s India, started by Dr. Ambedkar, the untouchable architect of the new Indian constitution, when he led them from Hinduism to the freedom of Buddhism, which was completed by our teacher and founder Sangharakshita. While Sean O'Casey was certainly not a Buddhist, and his understanding of the Buddha was at very best sketchy, his ideals were coming from a similar position as my own, and I feel he had had he but been exposed even to some of what the Buddha taught, he might have considered himself a Buddhist.